fleeting glimpses of things seen through a veil, darkly. Do we understand the meaning of these visions of life? Why we are here and how little of our existence we truly understand? Tonight we will talk of these things on The Other Side. Welcome to The Other Side. I'm Jim Harold. So glad to be with you once again. And today we're going to talk about a subject that has long mystified, and hopefully we'll get some clarity. I think we have a great person on the line to do that. The new book is Stonehenge, As Above, So Below. Our guest is Paul D. Burley. He's done a lot of work on this issue, and he's joining us from England today, and we're so glad to have him with us. But first, I have a couple of notes for you Plus Club members. First of all, I wanted to remind you there is a big webinar, one of these interactive video webinars that we do, coming up on April 21st at 10 p.m. Eastern. That's Monday, April 21st at 10 p.m. Eastern. Thomas Fusco, who has been on our programs and talked about his theory of supergeometry, and it's always been a popular program when we have Thomas on the show, is going to join us and in a two-part webinar, first part in April, second part in May, and he's going to cover paranormal mechanics, the information paradigm, and the Big Bang. And I can't wait to sit in on that. I enjoy these webinars as much as anybody, and I feel that I'm learning too. And the way that you join up is you can go over to jimharold.net, you know, of course, log in, and then you'll see the post there for Thomas's webinar. Click on it, and it will give you the link to register via GoToMeeting. And once you're registered, you'll get email invites and how to join and so forth. The nice thing is not only do you get to watch the video presentation, after the presentation, you get to ask Thomas questions via voice, or if you're shy or don't have the equipment, you can also type in your question as well. So I think that's a very underutilized piece of the Plus Club. So I hope you'll be able to join us. I'll also be sending out an email, probably maybe by the time you hear this, maybe not, but within the next couple of days, as I record this on the 11th of April, I'll be sending out an email to you, giving you the direct link so you can join us. I hope you can be there. Really looking forward to it. And another thing I'm looking forward to, with the redesign of the site, it's much easier to find over at jimharold.net, our forum section. We have some great stalwarts who always chime in there and have great things to say. But I know that since you're a member of the Plus Club, you are very interested in these topics. I'd love to see more of you there. So I want to remind you, and now it's very easy to get to you, just go to the top of the page, and in the menu bar on the page, it says Forum. You click on that, and you can start posting. And I think that we can really grow this online community, and I'm looking forward to hearing all your feedback on the shows. And I chime in also on the forums as well. So looking forward to that. With no further ado, though, today the subject at hand is Stonehenge, As Above, So Below. We have author of said book, Paul Burley. Paul earned his Bachelor of Civil Engineering and Bachelor of Science geology degrees from the University of Minnesota. He began his career as a construction engineer, and after a few years cutting his teeth in design, construction, and project management, he turned to geotechnical engineering and environmental geology in the consulting arena. He owned an engineering consulting company from 1994 to 2005, helping property owners and developers ensure their facilities were managed in ways that minimized potential impacts to human health and the environment. Over the course of 30 years, he investigated cultural development of thousands of sites across North America. He's also been an author. He had the Business Owner's Guide to Environmental Assessment. Now, he's interested in a lot of different things, including indigenous and ancient cultures, and he's presented professional papers addressing numerous engineering and environmental concerns, archaeological and ethnographic analyses of traditional Lakota culture on the Northern Great Plains, and symbolism found in sacred prehistoric artifacts. And he's turned his attention with his new book to Stonehenge. Stonehenge, As Above, So Below, Unveiling the Spirit Path on a Salisbury Plain. Paul Burley, welcome to the program today.
Hi, Jim. It's great to be here. That's a wordy introduction, but I appreciate you going through that.
Well, we got through it, and there's a lot of great data there. We like to know where people are coming from, and you're certainly coming from a place of expertise. Now, Paul, I know from your bio that you're very interested in North American sites, but what spurred you on to take a look at a serious look at Stonehenge?
after writing the book Sacred Sphere in 2011, the book came out in 2012, and it discusses the symbolism of the circle, which in all cultures, sacred symbols in terms of the circle are representing a spherical structure, and very few people know about that. That was the reason for writing that book. I decided that an excellent example of that symbolism as a circle would be Stonehenge. Many people know Stonehenge. They have some understanding of what it is supposed to be about. And the fact that it is a circle of stones within a circular ditch and bank, it was a perfect example to discuss sacred symbolism in terms of this very well-known ancient structure. So that's how I started on Stonehenge, and it ended up going off on tangents, but that's how I got going on it about 3 years ago.
One of the things that people look at Stonehenge and they marvel at is, how did a primitive culture move these huge stones? Where did they come from? I mean, aside from the spiritual significance and the cultural significance, just the engineering feat that Stonehenge is just causes one to marvel. What are your thoughts on the engineering behind Stonehenge?
Well, there are numerous theories that go as far as the stones were flown into Stonehenge from Wales and from about 30 miles north of where Stonehenge is located at a quarry. But I'm not so sure that we need to go that far with it. However, honestly, I don't know how they were able to accomplish it. No one knows. There are some very good ideas out there, but nothing's been confirmed or the evidence isn't strong enough. However, I will say this. If we had the dedication to constructing a structure such as that with 40,000 pound stones and having to drag them 25 to 30 miles or bring them around to Stonehenge on a course on along the shoreline of Britain, about 240 miles, we would find a way. And I believe that these people 4,500 years ago had the will. And where there's the will, there's the way. And they did it. We rely on current technology and cranes, so forth, to do that work. If we didn't have them, we would find a way to do it ourselves. And I think that's the best explanation, is where there's a will, there's a way. That's about all I can say about it. But I'm pretty confident that they didn't use metaphysical means to move these stones.
And in other words, you don't think that they levitated them or little green men came down and moved them around for them?
I don't see the evidence for it. One of my favorite sayings is, anything is possible. Few things are probable. And so, you know, I can't discount it. My opinion means very little in terms of how they actually did it. And so no one really knows, but I'm open to the possibilities. But until we can see that, you know, there is the ability to move these stones by levitation, I look towards more mundane means, I guess, along the ground surface in some fashion.
The fact that they did do this, though, and to your point about where there's a will, there's a way. There had to be an incredible will to do this, I would assume. Probably many, many, many man hours, ingenuity, back-breaking work, I'm guessing, went into this. So that will had to be due to some major motivation. Something really had to be motivating these people, I would think. So what are your thoughts on the motivation behind creating such an engineering marvel?
I'm right with you on that. They were tremendously motivated. The question is, what would motivate someone to this degree to bring hundreds, if not thousands, of people together over hundreds of years to take on this project and complete it? And my conclusion is, most Neolithic, that would be the New Stone Age, we're looking at anywhere from about 6,000 to 9,000 years ago, depending on where you are on Earth. This new Stone Age technology that these people had when agriculture was first starting up in Britain. When we look at Neolithic cultures around the world, they more often than not, have a package of technologies that is in combination with certain religious or sacred beliefs. And again, there are different cultural idiosyncrasies on that, but something that is in common is they didn't practice a religion one day a week or for 1 hour on one day and then go off and go to work and have their, you know, live their daily lives and then come back to that 1 week later. It's typically a sacred life that they are living 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Everything is sacred. They recognize the importance of relationships between themselves and the earth, for example, and they are in total reliance on the resources of the earth for them to survive. And they realize that their survival creates some dependence on other living things. And so all is one and one is all, that type of thing. And Native North Americans, people are probably familiar, are living this sacred life way in which everything is sacred, everything is important, and the purpose of life is to experience life. So I think that these people in Britain, being Neolithic, having that Neolithic technology and that culture, I suspect that they were living a sacred life way that encouraged them to pay attention to the earth, to each other, and to the cosmos. And they put together a package. They saw the world, the cosmos, as one large thing that they were a part of. And so they developed this will to do the work because it needed to be done. And the big reason why it needed to be done is they recognized, they believed, they knew, if you will, that they were a part of the earth and they were a part of the cosmos. The body is from the earth, the spirit is from the cosmos, from the sky. And that is an extremely common theme for people living in a Neolithic culture. Whenever that was, if it was Native Americans up until about 150 years ago, or people in Sumeria, Babylon, back 9,000 years ago, this Neolithic culture seems to drive, at least in part, this sacred understanding of I am part of everything and everything is a part of me. So that's where I think this is all coming from.
Now, you said hundreds of years. So this wasn't like a barn raising. Stonehenge, you believe, literally took hundreds of years to construct?
Well, the first evidence, the earliest evidence for any activity at the Stonehenge monument itself goes back thousands of years before the megaliths, the stones were placed. There is an indication of a lot of activity, but the circular ditch and bank that surrounds the structure is at least 500 to 600 years older than the stones. So this bank and ditch were put in place. Somehow the stones were brought in and placed without disturbing the ditch. So there was some work that was done in order to accomplish that. And there were timbers that were used, stakes were used, other stones were placed and removed, all prior to these large 40,000-pound stones being placed in about 2500 BC. So a lot of work had been going on there. This was a very important site. It was recognized as very important, and it remained so for thousands of years.
Now, let's talk about the size of the site and whether the site is entirely intact as best you can tell, because just the thought of something created so long ago, and it is still standing. I mean, it's still standing. If we have a home or a building and we leave it, without constant repairs and so forth, it'll fall down in 10, 20, 30 years. But this is maintained for thousands of years. So talk about how that's even possible. But what we see today is Stonehenge. Is that the entire site or was there more there, in your opinion?
Well, Stonehenge itself is that monument. And it's a several hundred feet in diameter. So it's a circular structure. It's not real large. In fact, a lot of people, when they first see it for the first time for themselves, say, is it only that small? So it's not as large as one might envision it to be, but there are over 400 other known monuments in the area of Stonehenge within about a 2 mile radius. There are many, many round barrows, which are round hills, small hills within which a person or several people would have been buried. There are long barrows that, so they're not round, but they're more cigar shaped, used for the same type of thing. There is a huge monument. It is about 1.7 miles long, about a football field wide, and there is a ditch and bank that surrounds that. And that's very critical to understanding what was going on this Stonehenge landscape. It's referred to as the Stonehenge landscape or the Stonehenge ritual landscape for archaeologists. So there are many, many structures out there. So Stonehenge is just this one little piece of the pie, but it is representing for us then this much larger feature, which I found at first people find it to be difficult to comprehend. It seems so happenstance and chaotic where different monuments were placed. But in fact, there was a rigorous engineering program put together initially before the stones were placed at Stonehenge back in about 3500 BC to map out, to survey out specific locations for the first monuments that went out there. This has not been recognized before, and this is one of the main topics of my book.
Now, you talked about the spiritual beliefs or the beliefs that you feel that the people, the Neolithic people who built this possessed. Can you tell us what other things we may or may not know about these people? What kind of lives did they lead? Tell us a little bit about the people, at least what you've gathered about the people who built Stonehenge.
Well, if you go back to about 4,000 BC or 6,000 years ago, the people in Britain were foragers, hunter-gatherers. And at about 4,000 BC, agriculture starts to move in. And when that happens, that's the beginning of the Neolithic, moving from the Mesolithic, which is the middle Stonehenge, to the Neolithic, which is the new Stonehenge, or the last phase of Neolithic, the new prehistoric period, which is just before the Bronze Age. So we're fitting in Stonehenge between the middle of the prehistoric era to the Bronze Age, when we start picking up history around the world. So we've got a period of about 1,000 years there. During that 1,000 years, people in Britain were slowly changing their cultures towards agriculture, from foraging to staying in place and building agricultural fields and growing grains and so forth. So this was very important too. This is a part of understanding that they are a part of life, because now they're actively involved in creating life so that they can survive. So that's a very important aspect of these people. The other thing is, it wasn't a static population. There was growth of population on Britain, with the island of Britain, which is Wales, England, and Scotland. And there were decreases and widespread increases over the course of hundreds of years. And between about 3800 BC and 3500 BC, again, we're 1,000 years before the megaliths get put in. About the time when this very large monument, 1.7 miles long, about 200 to 300 years before it was placed, there was a vast migration onto Britain from northern France. And those people had a history of agriculture. They were in the Neolithic already. They brought agriculture to Britain. They brought the technology of moving and placing these Mesolithic stones. They're found in many places of France and as well as in Spain, and they're older than the structures in Britain. So they are bringing technology, they are bringing culture, they are bringing new ways of life to Britain at that time. And shortly after that, and I should say, the center of this increase in population at that time is Salisbury Plain. So people were coming into the southern shoreline of Britain across the channel from France and moving northward, but only maybe 40, 50 miles and coming upon the Salisbury Plain. And this is where the major development of these monuments began to occur. And this is this area around the Salisbury Plain is the greatest concentration, greatest density of these types of structures. So it appears that it was a combination of the indigenous people and the people that moved in a couple hundred years before these structures begin to be placed, that the culture develops, that there's this realization that we need to undertake this construction. And it's just amazing what they were able to accomplish.
Now, did they actually worship at the site, in your view?
Again, there's no specific evidence on worship. However, it's understood, it's been known for several hundred years now that there are numerous bodies or body parts, bones, ashes, so forth, that have been buried at these various monuments around Stonehenge, around the landscape. And so the landscape is associated with the death of the body, and the body is placed in Mother Earth and those types of things. Well, we still basically do the same thing today. And so there are worship services that we can conduct today, funeral services, processions, and so forth. So there's every reason to believe that the people back then would have been doing the same thing. So I wouldn't be surprised at worship. They weren't worshiping the sun. They weren't worshiping the moon. They weren't worshiping the stars. I don't believe, personal opinion. I think that the moon, the sun, the earth, the stars, the planets were representing certain concepts, certain ideas. And that's why they paid attention to them, because these cyclic events that occur in the sky, the sun rises and falls each day, the moon rises and falls, the moon waxes and wanes over the course of 28, 29 days. And we have a summer, fall, winter, spring each year. They're recognizing these cycles that are important for them because of the agriculture that has taken on their activities day in and day out for much of the year. And so they're taking account of their activities in combination with the concept of time and cyclicity that are happening around them in nature, and bringing all of that together, and tying that in with the cycle of birth, life, death, and rebirth. So it wouldn't be surprising that they were worshiping at Stonehenge and at many, many other sites across Salisbury Plain and indeed across the island. I wouldn't be surprised at that at all.
Now, something that interests people who listen to these programs is the metaphysical. And you touched on a little bit that you don't believe there's any metaphysical explanation necessarily for the actual construction. But I've heard people who have been there, and I've not had the pleasure, that they feel some kind of metaphysical vibration. Now, do you think that's just a template that people, they're so in awe that they just kind of layer over it? Or do you feel there's some kind of metaphysical nature to the place?
As an engineer and a scientist, I thought it was a bunch of baloney too, but really didn't delve into it very much until 3 years ago. And I attended a conference in England at Glastonbury. And we took a tour, the last tour of the conference, and we had the opportunity to enter onto Stonehenge and walk amongst the stones during sunset. And people were putting their hands up near the stones. You're not supposed to touch the stones, but you can put your hand up close to them.
Right.
And I did so. I kept an open mind, and I just went with it. And I was extremely surprised. I can say there is certainly an energy in those stones that I could feel. There was a presence of energy being transferred between myself and the stones when I put my hands up within a half quarter inch. It's like a prickly feeling all over the hand. Hmm. And whatever stone I went to, in whatever location of a stone, I felt that, and I didn't feel it. When I stepped away, I wouldn't feel it. So there's certainly something there. I can't explain it. There are many theories. I don't have a problem with the theories. Everything's possible. Few things are probable. So there is a reason for it. There's something specific about it, but I can't explain it. But I certainly believe that there are energies there and in other locations on Earth, and they are connected by ley lines, if you will. There is something going on there, but we have very little evidence that really helps us pull that together yet. Whether these people knew that there were these energies associated with the stones or ley lines that are found across Britain, I don't know. It's very possible because there seems to be a link geographically. But I'm absolutely certain that these energies are there. They're present at certain locations in certain ways. I felt them. So there is something there that is worth continuing to pursue.
Now, in this day and age, with our iPhones and our fancy computers and all of the technology and everything that's developed, even over the last 20 or 30 years, why do we still care about Stonehenge?
It's an amazing structure that today, with all of the technology that we have, all the advancements that we've made, we cannot understand how it was constructed. We have very little information on who constructed and really no specific understanding of why it was constructed. So it's a puzzle. It's an enigma, and it has stood in place for hundreds of years. And it's very compelling then to try to figure out why a human being or a group of human beings would decide to design and plan and construct this structure. And then there's no evidence to get it for us that directly indicates why they did it and what its use was. So that's very strong in the human mind, I think, that curiosity factor. But when, through my studies in the last 3 years, what I found is that there's a much more of a connection that Stonehenge has with all of these other Neolithic cultures, which all people at some time in the past went through this Neolithic culture of beginning with agriculture and recognizing the importance of this cosmic dome above and earth below and the importance of taking part in the cyclicity of life. That's sort of a toolbox of culture took place across the world. And all of those Neolithic cultures seem to have left in some way, architecturally at least, evidence that this was the toolbox that they had and it was extremely important to them. And turns out, based on my analysis, that is exactly what was going on at Stonehenge, and it directly relates to the spirit in the source of life, the source of the spirit is from the stars. And that was commonly understood in Neolithic cultures. And the source of the body is from the earth. And they come together on earth as life, as living bodies, experiencing for a certain period of time on earth. This is what's really important, because the Neolithic people in Britain at the time were recognizing that life is created from two sources, one being from the cosmos, from space, and one from Earth. And this, in fact, is what the Stonehenge landscape and Stonehenge itself is all about. It is essentially a map of the stars constructed on the Earth so that we have both the presence of the stars, certain stars and constellations on the Earth's surface, so that we have the combination of the spirit and the body all together at one location. It's a reflection of the cosmos, really, something that has not been recognized at all. And so I'm bringing to the table the fact that they actually did this. And I was able to realize this through my experience with surveying. And I suddenly was finding that many of these monuments are placed at specific locations that are control points, if you will, that one would use to lay out a very large structure, such as virtually any engineered facility in the United States, tall buildings and suburbs and so forth. They're all laid out using surveying means. what I found is the exact same thing was done on the Stonehenge plane within 2 miles of Stonehenge back 5,500 years ago.
One thing that has always fascinated me is when you look across the world in the geographic distances that would have to be covered in the ancient world for cultures to have cross-pollination, or, you know, handing from one culture to another through trade routes and so forth. But the consistency of some of the lore, some of the memes, some of the archetypes across large geographical distances in the ancient world has always fascinated me. How did that happen? And in this case, you're saying, for example, you see common themes between this culture and the culture of Native Americans. Any speculation on how this could have been such an overriding meme across cultures that ostensibly would never have any contact with one another?
That is an excellent question, Jim. That is one of the questions that I pursued in my book, The Sacred Sphere, is a major theme of it, because it's very difficult to explain based on evidence, scientific evidence that we have. It's very difficult to explain why there's this common relationship between understanding sacred relationships and a very specific geometry, that being the circle. Why does every culture use the circle to represent sacred relationships throughout time and across the earth? And I essentially came up with three possible answers to that. One is that these cultures did have transportation and communication networks. They were in contact with each other, and it has continued throughout time. So something that culture would realize that was of importance in one location would be transferred to another location within sufficient time that there isn't change in that, you know, the communication, the message is delivered very well, very quickly. So transportation and communication becomes very important. The problem is, we don't have evidence for that being done, but it's possible. We have very little evidence, and scientists currently don't believe that there was that type of transportation and communication network going on. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is coincidence. It just happens that when people are at a certain cultural, technological stage, that these coincidences happen, where one of the effects is architecture exhibiting certain symbolism and geometry, and there are certain beliefs in terms of the spirit and the body, that suddenly it becomes this amazing commonality between all of these cultures. So, but it's just a coincidence that it happens. That's very difficult for me to believe, that it would just be coincidental. And again, little evidence to support it. The third one is cosmic consciousness or Christ consciousness. It has a number of names, but essentially we all have basically the same DNA, and we all pretty well think the same thoughts in certain situations. In other words, we're human beings. And so there's this energy that pervades the universe, these energies within the earth. We were talking about these ley lines and so forth. And so we are actually connected to everything else in the universe. We haven't quite got that explained and understood, but there's no question that we are a part of the universe, and the universe is a part of us. We're all made of star stuff. So with that in mind, this cosmic consciousness is simply the release of energy from ourselves and the receiving of energy around us. And I bring that up because it's very possible that consciousness then is something that is within us, that we can express out of us and also receive the consciousness messages coming from energies from beyond us, in other words, between people. So it's possible that it's just purely a consciousness issue within which we don't realize it as individuals, but as a complex species around the earth, we are able to communicate with each other and possibly even other life forms on this planet. And we really don't recognize that, but back in the Neolithic, there, you know, with this life way, which is extremely sacred all the time, trying to understand life and experience it, they may have been in tune with it more and have been able to use this cosmic consciousness as a source of information. So all three of those seem a little weird based on science and practicality, but that's what it comes down to. It's either transportation and communication networks, we have no idea, we can't explain yet. It's purely coincidence, well, you can't really explain that coincidence. Or cosmic consciousness, which again is something that physical scientists will put aside, they will shun that, and people interested in metaphysics will believe, but there are still big questions out there. But which one is it, or a combination? No one really knows.
Well, it's certainly a very compelling and fascinating discussion, and I don't think we'll get it solved in 30 or 40 minutes, but it's been a great discussion. Paul Burley, where can people find the book and more information on all the good work you're doing in regard to Stonehenge?
The book was published on March 28th, so it just came out, but it's available on Amazon, on the various Amazon online websites. And it's also available on barnesandnoble.com. So one can go online easily and order it. I know that it's discounted as books usually are on those websites. So you can get a great deal on either the paperback or the hardback edition. It is in the middle of being stocked in stores. So if you prefer to take a look at the book first and get it firsthand in a store, go to the stores and order it, and they will be glad to order it for you. In the near term, it might not be quite available there. But if you ask for it, that will force them to get the book in the store. So I would encourage people to do that. But you can certainly go online and purchase it.
Well, Paul Burley, we thank you. Today, the book is Stonehenge, As Above, So Below. We appreciate your time. It's been a pleasure, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you very much, Jim. It's been a pleasure of mine to be on the show, and I hope everybody will have some interest in what I have to say. There's much more detail in the book, but I certainly believe it's important for all of us to understand what was going on here 5,000 years ago.
That's what we do here. We talk about mysteries. I thank you so much for joining us today, everyone. And I hope that you'll be able to join me on that webinar that I told you about at the beginning of the program with Thomas Fusco. Look for that email, or if you're in a hurry, navigate over to the site and register for it, because there are limited slots available. And then secondly, I hope to see you on the forums, and we can grow that side of the community. So much easier to find now at the redesign of jimherald.net. And as always, we thank you for your time today. Hope you have a great week, and we'll talk to you next time on The Other Side. Bye-bye, everyone.